morning, good friends. Welcome. It's 4 p.m. Central Time. You're listening to my voice right here on the great GCN Radio Network. And that means it's now time for INN World Report Radio. Good afternoon, friends. Welcome to the program. My name is Tom Kiley, and I'll be your host for the next, just about the next hour or so, until the top of the next hour coming up. And welcome to the show. We are INN World Report, a group of independent media activists, or alternative media activists, I should stress, coming to you live every day at the same time period, Monday through Friday, from New York City, west side of Lower Manhattan, just about a half mile north of Ground Zero, in case you're familiar with the territory. If you ever went to the World Trade Center before it was destroyed, if you ever went down to see the pit, the site of the World Trade Center. By the way, speaking of which, friends, it's still in not a very good shape. There's a lot of argument going on how they're going to do the construction and so forth. It's really pitiful, actually, if you ask me, almost 10 years later. Anyway, we've got a great show lined up for you today, but first I'm going to tell you right now the phone lines are open, 866-582-9933. Please give me a call, and you'll get a book. I can send you out a book. I tell you, I've got several really good ones from the publishing house Trine Day that is helping me out with the program. They've given me some books. We're working with a lot of their authors, and you hear me talk a lot about the hot book from them right now, if you ask me, is the book about the CIA scientist, Dr. Frank Olson, who was killed. As a matter of fact, I got a few copies of those, so call me up and I'll send you a copy of that book. It is a monster. It's a 900-page book plus, but it's just fascinating, and the great thing about it is that you can read it chapter by chapter. Each chapter is kind of broken into its own section, and you can just find out amazing, amazing information when you read that book. And it's very, very well researched. You'll find it very, very interesting. I think I'm a pretty sharp guy. I do a lot of research, and I learned a lot of things reading that book, and that's why we like to have the author and people about that kind of material to come and for you to listen to, so that you can increase your store of knowledge, because you're certainly not getting this from the corporate media, from the mainstream media by any means. So ring me up, 866-582-9933, not a problem, and I'd be happy to ship you out a copy of that book. Friends, I'm always working to bring guests to you. As a matter of fact, before I continue with that thought, let me just tell you a little bit about today's guest, who will be joining us in just a few minutes. You don't want to go away, friends, because it's a very, very, very important topic. Stephen Valdik will be joining us shortly. He's a professor of law at American University, Washington College of Law, okay, where he is teaching research and focus on federal jurisdiction, all right, and national security law, constitutional law, especially the separation of powers and international criminal law. We've asked Stephen to join us because there's a very, very interesting case making its way through the Supreme Court right now. They call it Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, okay? And what they're fighting over is the notion, okay, that the court will hear oral argument, it did a couple of days ago in this case, a constitutional challenge to laws that make it a crime to provide material support to designated terrorist groups, even when such support consists only of speech aimed at reducing violence. Okay, human rights groups argue the material support laws violate the First Amendment because they punish pure speech and freedom of association, even speech that is intended to further lawful, peaceful, and nonviolent activity. So you can talk, you can have a group in your neighborhood that's designated a terrorist group and they're espousing violence, and you can go try to debate with them and try to convince them to use constitutional means to get their points across, and you could become swept up in the net as well. Okay, the government can come after you. So that's why we've asked Stephen Valdik to join us today. He'll be on in just a few more minutes, right on the other side of this break that's coming up. So that's the subject for today, constitutional law and government gone wild, and there's an awful lot of talk now. Barack Obama's been in power for over a year, right? And just as many, many people suspected, what is actually happening is instead of rolling back the excesses of the Bush administration, he's actually using them himself. And it's not a surprise to a lot of people, but a lot of his supporters, I think, are, you know, up for a rude awakening. And that's what we're going to be talking about with our guest, Stephen Valdik, after this. I want to tell you about another interesting guest that I'm cultivating. I might have him on for you on Thursday. But there is a professor in Florida, Lance DeHaven Smith, who I saw a reference to in 9/11 Blogger. And it really caught my eye, and I reached out for him. I was on the phone with him earlier today. He's sending me some material that I can go over, and I think we'll have him on Thursday for you. This guy has a lot of courage, friends. It's very important work that he's doing. He says his life was turned around by the theft of the 2000 election, and I know that the INN War Report was born out of that crucible, if you will, here in New York City. We figured the best contribution we could make to we the people would be to provide an alternative to the media that was just cheerleading the theft of that election, doing nothing to prevent it from happening, cheerleading, as it turned out subsequently, the march to war after 9/11, doing nothing to prevent that lie from spreading, in fact, spreading it themselves. And in any case, Professor DeHaven Smith started to focus on these events, and he's creating a category of law that he calls, get this, friends, State Crime Against Democracy, SCAD, S-C-A-D, State Crime Against Democracy. You can look him up, Lance DeHaven-Smith, and he's got his own website. A lot of his articles are scholarly, published in scholarly journals, so they're not quite available yet, but he is starting to come up with stuff that is more accessible to people. I'm going to have him on. I think a heroic effort. I have long, long dreamed of a day when we could get to a new classification of crime called crime against democracy. I mean, I don't think it's in a pure world, I guess it wouldn't be necessary, but I think it is necessary to highlight the fact that there is a special kind of crime, which I think should take very special penalties with it as well, when you try to thwart the will of the people, and not just here in these United States either. I think that if a country democratically elects their leader, whether they have a parliamentary system or republic or what have you, if the will of the people is fairly expressed and they choose their own representative form of government, it is not the business of the United States or any other country to go in there and overturn that election with a coup d'etat, such as, for instance, what happened in Iran in 1953, and on and on and on. That should be a crime against democracy. We should be prohibited from doing that, in my opinion. If you want to go to war with somebody, go to war with them. Declare war. All right? But don't send your secret shock troops in to undermine the democracy in another country because you've got some elites that covet the resources of that country, for instance. Okay, and they're going to put their own goons in to make sure that the oil flows, for instance, in your direction. I think it's just a great, great idea. He will probably be with us on Thursday if I can work through all the material. Tomorrow, Brad Friedman will be on from Brad Blog. He's just another person who got affected by, I think in Brad's case, it might have been the theft of the 2004 election, but we'll ask him tomorrow. Is either the 2000 or the 2004 election? But he's become quite a citizen activist, journalist, expert on elections. He also works on a lot of other issues. He's going to be talking with us tomorrow about egg corn, okay, and the whole row over that. Now, I don't know if you've seen it, but it turns out that these people that scammed egg corn with the pimp video, it turns out a lot of it was edited in after the fact. I don't even think the guy was wearing his pimp outfit when he was in Acorn itself, fooling people. So we'll find out about that tomorrow with Brad Friedman from Brad Blog. We'll be right back after this. America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central. For
9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming, top-of-the-hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon-free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to INNWorldReport.net.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN War Report Radio, 5 days a week right here on GCN from 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time, where we bring you the news the networks won't tell you, or if the networks are talking about it, you can bet that we'll be talking about it from a different angle than they're approaching it from. And it's very important, friends. There's a big case. I think it's a big case anyway, and that's why we've asked our guest, Stephen Valdik, to join us. A big case in front of the Supreme Court right now. We've asked Stephen, Professor Valdik, to join us. He's a professor of law at American University in Washington College, at American University's Washington College of Law, where he teaches, and his research is focused on, federal jurisdiction, national security law, constitutional law, especially separation of powers, and international criminal law. Stephen, welcome to INN World Report.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen, we asked you to come and join us today to talk a little bit about this Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, which I believe they just heard some oral arguments on just the other day. Can you tell us about the case?
Sure. I mean, so it's a fairly complicated case that's been going on for about 13 years now. But I'll try to give the sort of the Cliff Notes version. Basically, this all started in 1996. Congress passed a statute that made it a crime for any American or anyone in the United States to provide what it called material support to any group that was designated by the Secretary of State to be a foreign terrorist organization. And then the statute went on to define material support, or the thing that you can't give, as a whole bunch of different things, including training, service, personnel, expert advice or assistance, or any other number of things. And so the statute immediately right off the bat raises the question of what exactly those words mean. Congress, at least in 1996, wasn't very clear. This lawsuit started not long thereafter. The Secretary of State, back then it was Madeleine Albright, used her authority under the statute to designate two different groups. One is the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers Party from Turkey, and the other is the Tamil Tigers from Sri Lanka as foreign terrorist organizations. And the plaintiffs in this case are individuals and humanitarian groups that basically want to help these two designated organizations work toward peace and democracy in their countries. They want to support the nonviolent activities of these groups, and they're concerned that anything they do on behalf of these groups will subject them to incredibly severe criminal sanctions. So they sued to try to challenge some of the provisions of this statute, the material support statute, as violating their rights under the First and Fifth Amendments.
So, I try to come up with an example. You know, in Ireland, they had the Irish Republican Army and they had Sinn Féin, right? And Sinn Féin was the sort of political wing. I don't know many people that dealt directly with the IRA, but if they wanted to try to influence that side of the political equation in Ireland, I think they would interface with Sinn Féin. If they were designated a terrorist group, I guess you could get in trouble for trying to negotiate peace with them?
Exactly. Or, I mean, to tie it back to this case, you know, in the case of the PKK, one of the plaintiffs wants to help them advocate before the United Nations. And, you know, I think it's not hard to understand how in other contexts, providing money or providing training in certain kinds of weapons tactics would fall right within the heartland of what we think Congress should be able to prohibit. But to say that Congress can stop U.S. citizens from helping these organizations advocate before the United Nations seems problematic on multiple levels. First, it's interfering with the speech rights of those citizens. But second, it's antithetical to why we have the statute in the first place. I mean, if the goal here for all of us is to reduce the amount of terrorism in the world and is to actually sort of encourage stability and peace building in those parts of the world that have been conflict torn, we should want to be encouraging this kind of help and advocacy and not discouraging it. So that's where this lawsuit comes from.
I think it's also very strange to categorize speech as material support. I mean, the very word material sort of means material, doesn't it?
Yeah, although I guess, I mean, I agree with you in general. To give you the government side of it, suppose that I were a physicist and I used my training as a physicist to communicate to one of these groups ways of making better bombs. That's speech, but it's probably speech that we would all agree is not protected by the First Amendment. So, I think your instincts are exactly right. I think the problem in this case is that it's very difficult to draw the line between, here's how you make a bomb and here's how you advocate before the United Nations.
One wonders why they felt compelled to put the word material in there. You know, if they wanted to have it so broad, why didn't they just say any support of any kind?
Well, and I have to say, I mean, I think, we have to remember that the statute was passed in 1996. And so Congress may very well have had a different view of who were and were not terrorist organizations in 1996 than, say, it has today, or at least at any point after 9/11. So it's possible that, this is sort of good intentions gone bad, where Congress drafted an unfortunately ambiguous and open-ended statute, and where there's been pressure on successive administrations to really push the statute to the limits of its authority.
The other thing I think that's very problematic about what you're describing is the very notion of, what constitutes a terrorist, okay? The terrorist activity is terrorist activity, but depending on who is doing it and who it is aimed at, the Nicaraguan Contras come to mind, for instance. It seems to me that they were just as bad as any number of groups in the world, but it would be, I guess we would find ourselves hard pressed to be labeling them as terrorists, no?
Well, I think that's right. And I think so, there are two different things going on here. One is how groups get on this list in the first place. Now, to be fair, that's not currently, that's not part of the case that's currently before the Supreme Court, because if you are giving money or giving some kind of support to a group, you cannot challenge the group's designation on its own behalf. The group has to challenge it itself. So that's another part of the problem here, although it's not really right at the heart of what the Supreme Court's deciding in this case. But it does raise the larger question. If the Secretary of State has incredibly broad authority to place groups on this list in the first place, and if the statute is very vague in explaining what kind of support is prohibited, it seems like we've got a two-pronged problem with this whole regime, where cleaning up either part could actually, make the law a lot more clear going forward.
You're right, because it could seem like that certain groups are wished to be just totally isolated and not have anyone speak with them about anything. And I think your example is the best one of all. If you want to talk with them about making a peaceful situation, it's almost as if some people may be benefiting from chaos and terror and not want to have a peaceful situation. I mean, you could sort of read that. I don't know if that's what they intended or not, but it can certainly have that effect, can't it?
It can. And I think the real problem here is that I don't mean to be pity, but not all foreign terrorist organizations are equal. What we would be comfortable with for Al-Qaeda, I think, is, not necessarily what we'd be.
Let's just hold it there. I'm sorry, because we're going on a break. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Valdik. We'll be right back with him after this.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN War Report Radio, 5 days a week right here, 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time on GCN. And we're speaking with Professor Stephen Valdek from American University in Washington, D.C. We're talking with Professor Valdek about this case that's going through the Supreme Court right now, Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. Professor Valdek, you know, it's very interesting. You say this has been going on for 13 years. It's, what do they keep changing the name? Now Holder is in charge of the Justice Department, or is it really hasn't even gotten to the courts until now?
No, I mean, actually, this case started in 1998 as Humanitarian Law Project versus Reno, so that's how far we've come. I think there's an interesting, point to make there, though, that, this case is not really partisan. In ways that many of the other significant post 9/11 cases have been direct challenges to, say, the Bush administration. The position of the government had actually been remarkably consistent from the Clinton administration through the Bush administration onto the Obama administration, because in every case, this statute, is a very important tool in their ability to basically make these designated terrorist organizations, as one government lawyer put it, radioactive. There's no administration that has a problem with that. The issue is then, where's the line?
It seems to me like you could say, these people aren't stupid, right? So they can theorize that there are more than one kinds of speech that you could be using with a group like this. And you could be a Quaker. You could be, a nonviolent person who's talking with them, trying to cool down the violence, right? But what's their point? They don't want to get into the fine details to try to sort that out, or they don't even care. They would rather that kind of talk not happen.
I mean, I think the government's position is and has always been that any support for these groups, even if it's support for activities of which we approve, enables them better to carry out their violent activities and those activities of which we don't approve. So it's not that the government thinks it's wrong for, one of these plaintiffs to help one of these groups advocate before the UN. It's that advocating before the UN further solidifies.
Further legitimizes them, I guess.
Exactly. And so I think, the government's position, is not frivolous. I mean, the government's position is that they're entitled to err on the side of caution when it comes to foreign terrorist organizations. And I think the point here is that we're not focusing on this from the organization's perspective. We're focusing on this from the plaintiff's perspective, from these humanitarian groups and activists who have First Amendment rights and who want to exercise them.
Well, let's just assume that for whatever reason, the government was too clumsy to make this law delicate enough to allow, peaceful speech with such organizations. But that's the face value of this issue. What are the potential, hidden value or chilling effect, if you will? How can this law go metastasize and get even worse than its face value and in extreme examples be applied to groups that are not necessarily terrorist groups? I'll give you one example, for instance. George Galloway, the parliamentarian from England, is a frequent guest on the program, friend of the show. He was invited to speak in Canada. And there was a lobbying group that was successful in getting him personally labeled as a terrorist, even though the guy, doesn't even drink, and because of his support for the Palestinian people. And he was blocked from entering Canada. There's going to be a lawsuit, by the way, in Canada. We're wondering if he's going to be allowed to go there to defend himself. Well, that's a good example, I think, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is why I think it's important to understand why this case matters. I mean, whatever feelings one has about the PKK in Turkey or about the Tamil Tigers, this case is not just about them. And given how, difficult it is for groups to challenge their designation as a foreign terrorist organization, there's actually a rather profound chilling effect. I mean, if you are, a human rights worker who wants to go to Afghanistan and who wants to actually help our troops on the ground who are actively involved in peace-building initiatives, you actually may not be able to, depending on whether you know who you're talking to and whether the people who you're actually helping out belong to a group that's on this list. And I think the question is that really the kind of activity that we want to be suppressing, when it's exactly why we've retasked our military operation on the ground there, you know, that we really don't want citizens and civilians to be, you know, working toward the same goal. That's the paradox of this statute. You know, it's an anti-terrorism measure that may actually frustrate the ability of private citizens to actually help groups that have been guilty of terrorism in the past move toward a stable and nonviolent future.
And again, that's the that's assuming the government is fair and balanced when it applies the label of terrorism to a group. You mentioned the Tamil Tigers and the PKK. That was back when Albright was the Secretary of State. Has it been? I'm sure it's been applied to more groups since that time. Do you have how many groups is it applied to currently? Do you know?
Oh, I mean there are a couple of hundred groups on the list now. You know, some of them are groups we've never heard of. And some of them are. I mean, we've heard of Hamas, for example. You know, the Taliban, I think at least for a time, was on the list. You know, so there are large groups on the list. There are small groups on the list. There are, you know, groups you've never heard of. There are groups that are in the news every day. And as I said, you know, a little while ago, I think one of the problems with this whole regime is that it assumes that all of these groups are equal. And the reality, I think, is far from that. And so the lack of statutory nuance really comes through quite strongly when you look at the differences between a group like Al-Qaeda and a group like the PKK.
Well, a couple of points. First of all, the last I checked, I believe Hamas is the ruling party for the Palestinian people, correct?
Yeah, indeed.
So here we have the ruling party of that the Palestinian people have selected to rule them. And I believe it was an election that was very closely watched and they couldn't be debunked. So the ruling party for the Palestinian people has been declared a terrorist group, a party, by the way, that Israel helped get started. You know that history?
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, so the Israelis themselves helped Hamas get started because they thought they would be a real pain in the butt to Yasser Arafat. And somebody that they helped bring into existence is now somebody that's persona non grata, right?
I mean, I suspect if we look pretty carefully, we'd find a bunch of groups on this list whose origins, you know, are at least in some way traceable to, for lack of a better word, our own government or friends of ours. You know, the shifting politics on the ground, I think, is, you know, yet another reason why we should be careful here, because, you know, groups that we like one day, we can very easily come to dislike another day and vice versa. And so that's why I think so many people in this case are arguing that we should not be, you know, making these decisions based upon formal lines, but we should actually look at what kind of conduct the U.S. citizen at issue is actually undertaking. And is the conduct, you know, something that looks like it's protected by the First Amendment, or is the conduct something that we think Congress has the power to prescribe? More of a functional analysis based upon the kind of support that these plaintiffs want to give rather than a categorical ban on them doing anything.
Now, speaking on their behalf or speaking even to them? Like, I could theoretically want to speak with one of these groups to find out what's their beef. You know, I mean, how can you disarm a situation if you don't understand what the antagonists feel their issues are? Could you get in trouble under this law just to try to, as a journalist trying to interview these people to find out what's making them tick?
I mean, again, that's the problem is that the statute is vague. And so even I, as a lawyer, can't give you a definitive answer to that question. The statute makes it a crime to provide support and to provide service to these groups. And so the question would be if, you know, your speech to them, if you're talking to them, falls within either of those rubrics, then yes, Congress could prohibit it. And that's exactly why the statute has been challenged on the ground that it's vague.
All right, Stephen Valdik, we're going to come right back with you, professor at American University in the Law Division there at Law School. We're talking about this law that is prohibiting Americans from talking with a designated one.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central.
For
For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming, top-of-the-hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to innworldreport.net.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio, 5 days a week right here on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time. And we're speaking with Professor Stephen Valdik. He teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. We're talking with Professor Valdik today about the case Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. Been going on for quite some time, where Congress is trying to keep people from giving any kind of, even though the law reads material support, it could involve even speech to a group that they designated as terrorist. It started out originally, Professor Valdik, as just two groups, and now it's up to, what's the latest count?
The exact number is hard to say because it changes every day, but it's in the several hundred.
Unbelievable. And I guess they can even designate a person. I mean, I'm not saying that that we've done it here, but certainly Canada's used these kinds of laws to designate George Galloway, a British parliamentarian, as a terrorist, and kept them out of Canada.
There's a separate statute that dates to 1994 that makes it a crime to provide material support to a designated terrorist as opposed to a terrorist organization. I actually think there's slightly fewer problems with that statute because at least there, the point is that you're specifically helping an individual as opposed to a loosely defined group.
Now, Professor Valdik, you were telling me on break, this law is so crazy that it even seeks to prescribe speech to the Supreme Court itself. It even seeks to protect the Supreme Court's ears and eyes from speech generating from or in favor of or in support of one of these groups when they have to have something brought before the Supreme Court?
Well, so I wouldn't have thought so, but last Tuesday at the oral argument, that question came up, and Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General arguing on behalf of the United States, said yes, that a lawyer who writes and submits an amicus brief in support of one of these groups in a case before the Supreme Court is in fact providing services and expert advice and assistance in violation of the statute. And I have to say, I don't know if there was an audible sort of shock in the room when she said that, but it took a lot of the justices by surprise to hear that, that their own authority might be sort of interfered with by how broadly the statute is interpreted.
It must be news to the Olympians that even though they thought they were invulnerable, Congress feels that even they need to have their delicate ears and eyes protected, and Congress is happy to step in to do that. Boy, it must have been some opinion. Now, also, on this same subject, the law makes very strange bedfellows, right? And it's not entirely unheard of for a case to draw support from seemingly totally unexpected sources, and that often comes in the form of an amicus brief, correct?
That's right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And so we have this, we have this sort of general problem of is it really true that no speech, that no support, that no assistance to anyone on this list can ever be legal? And I think, we can fight about what would make sense as a policy matter. I have to think when Congress wrote the statute in 1996, they did not mean it to sweep quite as broadly as today the government argues it does.
I mean, I think it happens a lot, right, that you may find a group distasteful, but the law may be overreaching in certain aspects that you hold dear, and you may be motivated to help them on that point, you or others. I mean, that's not unheard of, is it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, Anthony Lewis put it very well. You know, he said the significance of the freedom of speech that the Constitution protects is freedom for the thought that we hate, not freedom for the thought that we like, because you never know when it's going to be your thought that the majority of the population hates. You know, I'm not by any means trying to suggest that Congress lacks the power to prevent you and I and anyone listening from supporting groups like Al-Qaeda, but I think we have to be very careful to recognize that there is a very significant line between helping groups who are only dedicated to violent acts of terrorism and helping groups that, you know, are guilty of some sins in their past, but that are actually working toward a peaceful future. Once we allow Congress to start interfering with those kinds of peace-building activities, you know, we're really allowing Congress to dictate who we're allowed to talk to and what we're allowed to talk to them about.
And that's just on the after-the-fact side of it. I mean, you know, it's not Congress who's deciding who goes on the list, is it? That's a much more narrowly defined group of people in the Justice Department. And what kind of review process is there for that, number one? And number two, it sounds like you could even get yourself in trouble trying to be involved in the review process itself, no?
Yeah, I mean, so the review process goes to the State Department. And what happens is you can first seek to challenge a designation before the Secretary of State herself. And failing that, you're allowed to take an appeal to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, the D.C. Circuit. The problem is that, you know, a lot of the groups that end up on this list don't have much of a presence in the United States. And if the government's argument is correct about amicus briefs, then someone who's here who goes to the D.C. Circuit on behalf of these groups could quite possibly be providing material support to them. And I think that's why the government's position in this case, I think, is still likely to fail, because it is so extreme, when I think there are any number of reasonable intermediate positions they could have taken that the court would be far more likely to have accepted.
So, Professor, let me get this straight. At the discretion of the Secretary of State and or his or her organization, group XYZ in country ABC is put on this list, and maybe there's some people who know much more about this group within the United States that said, wait a minute, you made a mistake here. These people are not terrorists, really. We want to appeal that. So they appeal directly. I don't know. Who could appeal? I mean, who's going to stick their neck out even to make the appeal under these kinds of laws? Number one, directly to the Secretary of State. And then failing that, you've got to go to the courts. And is this a self-sealing system where, you know, no one's even allowed to, it's radioactive, nobody's allowed to participate in the appeal itself?
I mean, I think that's exactly how the government got into trouble before the Supreme Court last week. You know, I think the answer has to be no, that there's at least a meaningful opportunity to challenge the group's initial designation, and that, you know, American lawyers have to be allowed to participate in that process. But this is exactly why the vagueness of the statute is what's causing the problem, because, you know, the same statute could be read as plausibly supporting this, even though I can't imagine Congress ever would have meant to have gone that far. That's exactly why we have this body of law known as vagueness, which says that, you know, a statute has to be reasonably clear to the average reader what it's actually prohibiting, or else it runs into the First Amendment. And that's exactly the grounds on which I suspect the court will find some of the provisions here are unconstitutional.
I mean, our whole system is based on the fact that you can ask questions, you can challenge your status, right? I mean, that's why we have something called the Supreme Court, because that's as far as it goes, right? Because if no one can make up their mind below that, that's where the issue can finally be settled. But
that's right.
How can you have a system where you're not even allowed to challenge once it's been you've been put under this kind of a designation? Doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, and I think it wouldn't have made any sense to the Congress that wrote the law in the first place, which is why I suspect the end game here is that the court will strike down some of these provisions and suggest that if Congress wants to, you know, step in and clarify things, it's free to do so. And I think we'd all be better off that way. I mean, I think, you know, having this go back to Congress, having Congress legislate more precisely is a good thing here from everyone's perspective and not just from the plaintiffs.
And let's not forget that Congress can often be the targeted by political movements and actions and scared into passing lousy legislation. And I think I'm not sure if that's the case when this legislation was put through. It certainly was the case, for instance, when the Patriot Act was brought into law. You know, that's so crazy, this thick thing, and nobody had a chance to read it. You know, it's supposed to be the consent of the governed, right? But lousy law can be rammed through, under pressure. And, you have to be able to challenge it in the courts, no?
I would think so. I mean, I think, one of the themes that we have seen in the cases over the last few years is that whatever very different views the federal judges and justices might have of the merits of these cases, there's a consensus that it is up to the court at the end of the day to have an opportunity to pass upon them.
Well, Professor Valdik, thank you very much for joining us today. Is there a website people can go to learn more about you and or this case?
Well, I mean, I'm sort of just a commentator. If folks are more interested in this case, I direct them actually to the website of the lead plaintiff, the Humanitarian Law Project, to learn more about the Supreme Court and about what it's likely to do or once it decides the case, what it's actually done. I encourage people to check out SCOTUS blog, SCOTUSblog.com, which is one of the best resources out there for following the Supreme Court.
Excellent. SCOTUSblog.com. Thank you very much, Professor Stevens Valdik, Washington University. And friends, tomorrow, Brad Friedman is going to join us. They've exposed this hoax that was perpetrated on Acorn. He's going to tell us all about it.